Okay, I'd like to convene the Ways and Means Committee. We are going to be conducting this morning's meeting under House Rule 10.01, which is posted online. And so I'd like to say good morning to everyone. And we do have a quorum present. Representative Nelson, would you like to move the minutes?
I'll move the minutes for May 5th, 2020.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion on the motion to approve the minutes? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. This morning's agenda is that we're going to be hearing from MMB, and they're going to be going over a bit of information, if you will, let me put it that way, about the federal funds. Some of us had a preview last Thursday evening, if I recall correctly, both sides of the aisle, and some of the members of this committee had some questions about it. And so, Commissioner Kranz, we decided that we'd like to bring you in to go over basically that information that you did that evening, and then also perhaps you have more information in the past few days that you can share with us as well. So at this point, Commissioner Kranz, I'll turn it over to you. We are going to attempt to put up some of the charts and graphs. Staff will be doing that. Being that we're all dealing with new technology, we'll do the best we can with that. Commissioner Kranz, if you could identify yourself then for the record, and we will get started. And it looks like the information is up.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Myron Kranz, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. Do you want to go through this funding overview first or the budget projection information first, Mr. Chair?
Well, they're both on the agenda. I was thinking we would do the federal first and then the we could go over the budget projections, but I'll give that choice to you, whichever you're prepared to do.
Well, I think it might, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, I think it will start with the overview of the budget projection. The state economist, Dr. Columbakidis, is on with us now, and Britta Raton, the budget director. So we'll run through that, and we'll go through this pretty quickly, because as you indicated, this has been out there. We briefed the legislature and the leaders yesterday in the press conference, but we'll go over it in a really high level and then open that up for questions. And then I think that'll give us plenty of time to go through the funding overview and the work group.
Okay, and Commissioner, as you and I talked, the idea was on the budget projections to have an opportunity for members to have questions after they've digested it a bit. So that sounds fine. So let's proceed that way.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, members, for joining us this morning. Let's go to the first slide. I think that the what we want to do is talk about the unique situation. Obviously, we all know about, no surprise. And this is a chance for us to gather this information, the best information we can put together. I think one of the things that we believe that we could do to assist the legislature and the governor working together in May was to provide this updated interim budget projection. The budget projection informs all of you about the decisions and the resources we have available. The projection is limited to this biennium, 20 and 21, based on the difficulty of getting more detailed information. We will be making, obviously, in November at the very latest, information about the forecast for the next biennium as well. I'll let Dr. Columbakidis talk about the major revenues and Budget Director Raton talk about the expenditures. But as we all know, the bottom line is that right now we have a $2.4 billion projected deficit for 20 and 21. That's before the use of any reserve or making any other adjustments. So let's go to the next slide and let Dr. Columbakidis talk a little bit about why what happened and why we're in this situation. Dr. Columbakidis?
Yes, thank you, Commissioner.
Welcome, and if you could identify yourself for the record.
Of course, sorry. For the record, I'm Laura Columbakidis, economist. Thanks, Commissioner. Thanks, Chair, members of the committee. So I'm going to walk through, as Byron said, a high-level overview of the U.S. economic outlook. I'm going to talk about Minnesota's outlook and how that's changed, and then I'll review the changes on the revenue side. So as you know, the outbreak of COVID-19 and the measures taken to prevent its spread dramatically weakened the outlook for U.S. economic growth since our forecast was released in February. IHS is now forecasting, IHS Market is our macroeconomic consulting firm, and their April outlook is the one that informs our new projection. IHS is now forecasting a three-quarter contraction or decline in real GDP this year, which will constitute a 5.4% decline in real GDP for the year. The chart you have in front of you now shows real GDP. It shows the level. So usually I show you growth rates, but this time I thought it was useful to show the level. And so the dark line is the history, and it's IHS's April outlook. And the dotted line is their February outlook. So the dotted line is the path we thought we were on in February. And then you can see when, in the quarters of 2020, you can see three declining data points. So those are quarters for GDP in the first three quarters of this year. Of course, one of the biggest things that happened here is that consumer spending, which accounts for about two-thirds of U.S. GDP, has been hit hard by the pandemic crisis. So we've had temporary business closures, social distancing measures, volatile financial markets, rising unemployment, declining wages. All of those things combined to contribute to a 5.5% decline in projected consumer spending this year. So you've heard me say in the past that consumer spending was the engine of this historic economic expansion we were in, and the COVID-19 crisis managed to hit consumer spending particularly hard. IHS notes that their economic outlook depends critically on the path of the pandemic. They expect the assumptions underlying their outlook are that they expect the spread of COVID-19 to peak and then dissipate in early summer, allowing social distancing restrictions to be lifted during late summer or early fall. And then economic recovery begins in the third quarter, or begins at that time in the third quarter, and real GDP turns positive toward the end of the year. So in this graph, so each data point is a quarter, you can see the fourth quarter of 2020, and this is calendar years, the fourth quarter of 2020 turns positive. It starts to come back up. And real GDP is forecast to grow 6.3% next year. So looking at that dark line again, you can see that as recovery starts to happen here, IHS expects GDP to reach its pre-pandemic level in mid-21. But within our projection horizon, GDP does not get back to where it would have been without the pandemic. And so we never get back to that dotted line. Some amount of GDP, some amount of economic activity is simply lost here. And what I mentioned in the webinar and in the press conference yesterday is that, you know, this is just real GDP, right? So I could show you graphs for components of GDP, such as business investment, such as consumer spending, which informs our sales tax forecast, such as total wage and salary income, which informs our income tax forecast, and all of the level charts would look this way. So they would have a big plunge this year and then a recovery, an increase next year, but never getting back to the path that we used to be on. Also for your information, the April outlook by IHS reflects all of the fiscal and monetary policy measures taken prior to the first week of April, including the CARES Act and all of the monetary policies that were taken at that point. The shock to the U.S. economy from this pandemic is unprecedented. It's unprecedented in modern U.S. history, and the outlook is exceptionally uncertain and volatile. So some of the dependencies here are that the economic outcomes are going to depend, as I said, critically on the pandemic's course. So if the pandemic changes, or if IHS changes their view of what happens with the pandemic, their outlook is going to change. It depends on the prospects for an effective treatment and vaccine. It depends on government restrictions on economic activity. But even more so than that, it depends on consumers' and businesses' responses as those restrictions are lifted. So it's not it's not as much about trying to figure out what governments are going to do. It's more about trying to figure out what consumers and businesses are going to do. It also depends on the impact of fiscal and monetary policy. So all of those things create risk for this forecast because those are dependencies. The U.S. economic outlook is going to remain volatile and uncertain for some time. So it's going to remain a bumpy ride. Let me turn to the next slide and talk about Minnesota's outlook. Minnesota started this or entered this crisis, as you know, with low unemployment, high demand for labor. We've had a long string of positive employment growth, so job additions, but our employment growth had slowed, and that was due to the constrained labor supply. So that was the situation when we started. And then the disease outbreak and the restrictions applied to slow its spread and the U.S. and global contractions, so the U.S. and global recessions that are happening now, those have rocked Minnesota's economy and generated conditions that will remain volatile for as long as the pandemic persists and as long as the U.S. outlook remains uncertain. We don't have a lot of real-time data about what's going on and about how this has affected Minnesota's economy. The economic data lag what we see every day out there in the economy. But one of the what are called high frequency data points, one of those high frequency data points is unemployment, initial claims for unemployment insurance benefits. And those get released regularly, they get released weekly. And so they give us a better idea of what's actually going on in the economy. And according to Deed, since mid-March, an unprecedented 600,000 Minnesotans have applied for benefits. So that's been a dramatic increase in unemployment in Minnesota, although the official unemployment rate numbers haven't caught up with that yet. So in this chart, we show the annual growth rate in total Minnesota wage and salary income. So the variable we're showing here is total wage and salary income, which means take all of the payrolls for all of the employers for the entire state and add them up. And then the height of the bars shows what the growth rate, the annual growth rate in that variable. So the dark bars show our history and the striped bars show our new projection as of this new projection. So as employers reduce hours, cut pay, lay off and furlough workers, we estimate that Minnesota wage and salary income will decline 5.9% this year. It'll start growing next year, but it doesn't reach its pre-pandemic level until 22 in our projection. So turning to the next slide in the revenue projection, general fund revenues are projected to be $3.611 billion less than our February forecast, and every one of the major tax types has had a reduced projection here. Individual income tax receipts are projected to be $1.659 billion less than what we had forecast in February. That decrease is primarily due to that lower weight or that wage decline that I mentioned in the previous slide, but also projected declines in non-wage income, such as capital gains and business income. Sales tax revenue is projected to be $1.351 billion lower than the prior forecast, and that's consistent with that decline in consumer spending that I mentioned before. The corporate tax is projected to generate $405 million less than the prior forecast, and that's due to a lower projection in corporate profits. In the final slide, I'll reiterate some of the risks I've already talked about. So I talked about the path of the pandemic and how that is changing, or at least our understanding of it is changing, and that will change the economic outlook. There's also the path of consumer and business confidence. So I talked about how what really matters here is trying to figure out what individuals and businesses are going to do. And how they react here. Businesses are in an extraordinary period of uncertainty right now, trying to, especially those that have been temporarily closed or have seen revenue declines during this crisis. Consumers are trying to figure out when they will have the means, but also when they will have the trust in public safety to get back out there and do the spending that that generates economic activity. Financial market volatility can dampen consumer spending when equity prices go down and consumers have less wealth. And then while the impact of federal fiscal and monetary policy is embedded in the U.S. forecast that we used to inform our projection, that impact is uncertain. And future federal fiscal policies and monetary policies are uncertain. So that creates uncertainty as well as any additional federal support for the state for states. And then I think I've talked to you about this before, that tax payment delays that have been allowed during the crisis to help out taxpayers, that helps out taxpayers, but it also delays signals that we normally use to identify how the economy is affecting the revenue streams. And so those signals are muddied and delayed for us. And so that's one of the risks here, is that we we'll learn something when those delays are done, when those delays play out, that is different from what we think right now. And so the picture should be clearer for us late in the summer, but it's not going to be much clearer between now and then. And then, of course, as Meyer mentioned, this projection is for the current biennium, which is still 14 months away, and a lot can happen between now and then, and it probably will. Thanks. I can end there and pass it on to Budget Director Bridger Raton.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes. And welcome.
Okay, good.
For the record.
Yes. This is Britta Raton, State Budget Director, and I'm going to turn to the expenditure side of the forecast. Estimated spending is up $391 million relative to our previous projection in February. And this change has two parts, which are broken out on the slide. The first of which is the spending enacted by the legislature during this session since the February forecast, and that's in the enacted legislation column. And that totals $550 million, which is increased general fund spending primarily in response to COVID-19. A portion of this spending will likely be redirected to federal funding sources, either directly redirected in law to the Coronavirus Relief Fund or through receiving FEMA reimbursement as we spend these dollars on FEMA-eligible expenditures. But as of right now, this money is coming from the general fund, so we're reflecting current law and showing it coming from the general fund. The other part of the change is the projection change. And the only bill area where we did a re-estimate in spending projections with this budget projection is Health and Human Services. And that's because Health and Human Services spending tends to be more variable based on the economic conditions, and it tends to be counter-cyclical to the economy, as the participation in public programs tends to increase during economic downturns. So the underlying economic data does drive increased participation projections in this estimate, particularly in fiscal year 21. And that increased participation drives increased costs of about $164 million. But those costs are actually offset and more than offset by additional federal funding for the medical assistance program that was passed since the February forecast. And that was part of the Families First Coronavirus Response Act passed by Congress. And Minnesota is expected to get $330 million in increased federal match for the medical assistance program. So when those two factors are combined, we actually see reduced state spending projected in this updated projection of $160 million. So the combined impact of the enacted legislation and the projected change results in a spending increase of $391 million. If you turn to the next slide, the next slide brings together, and I'm not sure, thank you. The next slide brings together the whole picture of the revenue and expenditure side. And so as Dr. Kolumbakidis explained, the revenue projection is down $3.611 billion compared to the previous estimates. And then as I just walked through, the expenditure estimates are up $391 million compared to February. And then there's also a change in the amount of the stadium reserve. And that estimate for the amount in the stadium reserve has decreased by $63 million since our last forecast. So that leaves an estimate of $66 million in the reserve by the end of FY 2021. And the reason for that change is a dramatically reduced gambling revenue number compared to our February forecast. So the overall changes leave us with the projected deficit of $2.426 billion. And you can see that in the lower right-hand corner of this slide. And then I'll pass it back to Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, this is Myron Franz. I'll conclude this and open it up for questions. So as you all know, we've been working diligently over the last number of years, 9, 10 years, to recover from the Great Recession. And I think we've done a very good job about that. It does provide us with an opportunity to manage this crisis in ways that I'm not sure all states have the same opportunity that we do. But I think knowing that we have the $2.359 billion reserve, and based upon our hard work to save 33 or 1/3 of every November forecast surplus into the reserve, has really worked quite well since 2014. The thing that we want to talk a little bit about in the next presentation about the use of federal funds and other funds and state funds is the challenges that we have to figure out how to rebalance the budget. So what happens under statute is that when we make a budget projection and the budget projection shows a deficit, that gives the governor the authority to use the budget reserve. The question then becomes how much of the reserve should we use? And so I think that's one of the things that we want to talk to the legislature about and get your views on as well. So the other thing that people have asked me about is the unallotment process. Some of you have been through this before, but the unallotment process is a statutory method where previously appropriated dollars under current law can be canceled or reduced. But this occurs by the governor only if the reserve has been fully depleted. So that is another budget tool that is available after the depletion of the budget reserve. I just want to make a couple of comments and then we'll open it up for questions. And that is the caution really is we don't know for certain, obviously, what's going to happen and whether this recovery will take place the way that IHS market has predicted or not. I think Dr. Klumbakidis explained the risk, and the risk is if we use all of the reserve fund now, there won't be any left if things get worse. I think that's the challenge, is the other budget tools that we have available need to be implemented fairly soon if we're going to use them, or we'll lose that opportunity. And if we spend all the reserve, we won't have any reserve left in later this fall or winter if we need it. So the other thing that I would like to mention is this, the ongoing nature of our challenge. We worked really hard. I want to give a lot of credit to Dr. Klumbakidis and her team, the economic forecast team, and Budget Director Raitan and her budget team. We did a lot of work to get this ready, knowing that we were relying on information that we would like to have a lot more. So we are, we're uncertain about the future, as all of us are, about the extent of this spread of the virus and how quickly the economy recovers. And so we're concerned about making sure that we have some flexibility in the future. But that's, like I say, one of the decisions we wanted to put together with this budget projection in May. The goal was to give all of you the best information we have at this time to make whatever decisions we need to make by May 18th. And the point I made yesterday and the governor made yesterday was that this may be an ongoing, it's likely to be an ongoing process. Let's just go to the next slide. I'll just mention this slide because the next slide really is the beginning of the next presentation. So we'll get into the interplay of federal funds, state funds, but that's the discussion for the next phase of the conversation. So I think what I'll do is I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, and open up for questions. Maybe we can go back to the previous slide and just have questions about the this presentation.
Yeah, Commissioner, we have several people that have indicated they have questions relative to this part of the presentation. I have one of Dr. Klumbakidis. She referenced, Columbakidis, you referenced the delayed tax payments. Have you built in any potential best guess projections in terms of what kind of revenue will be coming in? I think it's July 15th is the due date. Or is that just off the table relative to your projections? Or that Commissioner or Dr. Columbakidis, whichever.
I don't mind starting, Mr. Chair, and then Commissioner Britta may want to add something. On the revenue side, we did estimate, for instance, if you think about the income tax delay, our income tax projection has a base year, and we estimate the base year liability, and then we project from there. The base year of the income tax projection is tax year 19. So it's those final payments for tax year 19, that those final payments and payments with extensions that normally would have come in on April 15th, those were delayed until July 15th. And so we did estimate both what we thought that total would be, what we thought would be those final payments and extension payments, and then how much of it would be delayed until July 15th. I don't have that estimate in front of me, but that's definitely baked into our analysis here. And we did similar things with the sales tax delay.
Okay, that answers the question. I wasn't interested in what the specific number may or may not be, but that you did have a projection built in as to what would be collected by July 15th. Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning. I assume you can hear me okay?
I can. I assume everybody can.
Yes. Thank you. So first of all, I want to thank each of our testifiers for the work they're putting in today. Obviously, we at the legislature have come to expect a level of accuracy in our budget forecasts, and I respect the work that these individuals are doing to try to accomplish this. But I just want to emphasize the testimony we heard, and that is that we have really unprecedented volatility ahead of us. The assumptions we have to make with regards to consumer confidence, what new therapies get developed, whether a vaccine is created, federal action, consumer confidence, all these things add up to an extreme amount of volatility going forward. And I do want to thank all those involved for at least giving us some sort of recognition of where we think we're heading. So a couple of questions. First, for Commissioner Franz, given this volatility that we're facing, what level of change in revenues and or expenditures would trigger, in your opinion, it would be wise to trigger a second revenue update or another revision to these numbers?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Garofalo. I'll let Dr. Columbakidis chime in too. But from our point of view, that is you really asked a key question. And so Dr. Columbakidis and her team need that data to assess and make this, let us know what's happening. So as you know, every month we provide, in fact, on the 10th of this month, we'll provide the revenue numbers for the month of April. So I think what you've hit on is, what are those triggers? What are the kinds of things, and what kind of data would tell us, oh my goodness, this thing is a lot worse than we thought. And that is the nature of what I've been talking about, is let's solve what we can in May. But let's recognize that July, August, September, that's going to give us data that may make us really happy and may make us really quite depressed. It's just, who knows? Because we don't know how quickly the economy is going to turn around and recover. So the my answer to you is there is a level that would cause us either to do another budget projection and or a forecast. But let me let Dr. Columbakidis talk about what it is she's looking for in the data to give us the warning systems. Dr. Columbakidis?
Mr. Chair?
Dr. Columbakidis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for that question. What are we looking for? That is a great question. So one of the things I will be looking for for the U.S. economic outlook to stabilize. So right now, you know, IHS, the forecaster that we use, they always produce one forecast a month. In March, they produced three because the conditions were changing so quickly. Now they're back to their regular monthly schedule, but we do expect larger changes month to month than what we normally see from them. And so their outlook, the U.S. economic outlook, is going to stabilize as I think we understand the disease progression more, as we understand the impact of new restrictions or lifting restrictions, as we get a better understanding of whether there's going to be a second wave of the virus later in the year. So I would want to see some months go by of the U.S. economic outlook not changing dramatically month to month. I talked about the really unprecedented, just hard to even imagine, number of unemployment insurance claims that we've seen in Minnesota, and that has not played itself out through either the unemployment rate data yet or necessarily the withholding data, the income tax withholding data that we watch on a regular basis. And so I would want to see, to be confident that the withholding data that we're tracking is reflecting those layoffs so that we can get a better idea of whether that wage forecast I told you that we did is on the right track. So I need some time to see those unemployment insurance claims play out through the rest of the economy. I need to see these revenue payment delays play themselves out, so that we can see, okay, this is actually what tax year 19 tax liability was. And then we know that the base of our projection is more solid than what it is right now. Or this is what sales people who are remitting sales taxes are actually collecting in sales taxes, because right now that's unclear because we have sales tax payment delays. And so that will help us see what is going on with consumer spending in Minnesota. So those are the kinds of things that we are watching, that we're looking for, and that once that bulk of information plays its way through into the economic data, then I'll feel more comfortable adjusting things.
Mr. Chairman, to any of the testifiers, is it fair to say that the three things that members should be looking for the most, not exclusively, but the most in terms of whether this forecast will hold or not, would be number one, whether IHS submits new forecast data to us, whether they adjust their assumptions. Number two would be if revenues come in either substantially above or below where they're projected right now on a monthly basis. And then third and finally, if the federal government were to pass some sort of, I don't know what number we're on, no, COVID 5 or COVID 4 stimulus plan. Is it fair to say that those would be the three variables members should be watching the most to understand whether this forecast will hold?
Mr. Chair, and I'll let the other testifiers comment as well, but I think so. I think, you know, the macro indicator of IHS is going to be important in terms of what's going on around the country, because obviously the whole economic situation in the U.S. does affect Minnesota. And tracking those revenues is going to be really critical. And there's a lot of talk about CARES 4 or whatever stimulus package we're thinking about. You know, there's been a lot of comment about that. There's a lot of discussion about a stimulus package. A lot of economists that I've read have talked about what's happened thus far. They've been really, really recovery kinds of bills. And what a lot of economists are looking for is a stimulus bill that would help the states and local units of government replace their lost revenue specifically, and to maintain service level, to help facilitate and not exacerbate the current economic situation. But so those are the things that I sort of eyeball. But Dr. Klumbakidis, do you have anything else?
Mr. Chair, can I jump in here?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that question. And I'm really glad that that members of the legislature are watching these same things that we're watching. That's very helpful to us. I would add, yes, those are most important. Those are very important things. I would add two points to what you said, Representative, and what the commissioner said, and that is tracking how the revenues come in relative to this new projection is going to be is going to be a little bit of a delicate thing, or more nuanced interpretation maybe, because we have these payment delays and because so many things are uncertain about how this is playing out through the revenue system. And so when we make our reports, you know that in our quarterly report on revenues, we give a more detailed description of what we think is going on. And so I will make every effort to make sure that when there's something that might be a little ambiguous or the interpretation might be a little nuanced, I will make sure to say that and say, you know, it looks like revenues have come in, you know, short of forecast or above forecast, and that has something to do with the economy. But actually, our analysis shows that it has to do with something in timing rather than something real, something underlying the economy. So just treat those, our revenue reports, understand that there's volatility behind the revenue streams, and go ahead and ask us questions about what things mean so that we can give you those nuanced interpretations. And then the other thing that I hope everybody is watching and that really will affect the path of the economic outcome is changes in our understanding of the disease progression and treatments and vaccines. And so maybe that's obvious, maybe that was underlying your suggestion that we pay close attention to the US outlook, but that, you know, things that happen with the disease will can change things significantly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the response to that. I appreciate the answers. Two really quick questions. First of all, thank you. And to the testifiers, so with the temporary reduction in or temporary suspension of most elective procedures, other states have been able to recognize savings in their forecast, assuming that, you know, there's a reduced Medicaid match on those elective procedures. They're simply not taking place. The state that comes to example is Colorado, where they've been able to realize temporary savings as a result of that. Was that factored into our this assumption, and any idea how much in short-term savings is generated as a result of that?
Mr. Chairman, I'll let Budget Director Raton take that question. Thank you, Representative.
Representative, thanks for the question. Our situation is a little different because most of our medical assistance program is managed care, and so we pay rates. So we will see if there are cost savings, we'll see that reflected in the rates that are reset in 2021. Given the lag there, that is not really accounted for in this forecast because the assumption is that some of that care is simply delayed. But we will revisit that through the rate setting process. We also didn't include that because it's still kind of an unknown what the increased cost will be relative to COVID treatment. Where we did see a reduction in costs based on usage is actually in our long-term care side, because we have seen some reduced usage of day services for long-term care as well as the population in our nursing homes.
Thank you, and Mr. Chairman. And then my final question for Commissioner Franz, and thank you all again. I know you guys are putting in monster long days, so thanks for being available and being a resource for us. In terms of the pathway ahead, Commissioner Franz, do you expect the governor's going to be submitting a revised supplemental budget, given this updated forecast? And if so, what do you view as kind of the goalposts for that time frame?
Representative Mr. Franz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thanks for the question. Yeah, I do want to shout out to the folks that are in many of the different agencies that are working really hard. We tried it about a month ago to implement a mandatory day off for our staff. And today is my mandatory day off. It's it hasn't worked yet. I'm not complaining. It's we work hard because we believe it's what we need to do, and we're earnest in what we're trying to help with. But it is long hours and long days. So thank you for that recognition. I appreciate that. So the goal of today, of yesterday, putting out the budget projection, and then today talking about it with you all, is to admire the problem a little bit, in the sense that we wanted to articulate as best we could the nature of our current budget situation. And of course, all to sort of agree, this is the reality, the new reality that we have. and what we want everyone to think about it and come up with suggestions. Yes, the governor is working on providing a, quote, solution or a new budget package to put together to solve the new math problem. So as I mentioned, this is a math problem. You have the revenues dropping, spending going up equals a budget deficit. So we've got to figure out what to do about the revenues and the spending in order to re-equalize that budget balance, either through the use of revenue changes, spending changes, and or use of the budget reserve. So yes, we're working on that, and we'll hope to come out with that very, very soon. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Groffalo, was that it?
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, do you have a rough time frames for what members can expect in terms of when that'll be taking place?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yesterday is kind of the goal. Within a day or so. I mean, the goal really is, within the next several days, because we obviously only have less than 2 weeks left. And so the key is to put this together. So we're literally working before this and after this to try to get that ready. So very, very shortly, within a day or so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your indulgence. Appreciate it.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you are being put in a very untenable position, and as you and I have talked in the past, I'm sure that you would appreciate providing us with a little different set of circumstances. My first question actually goes to the comment you made about the CARES Act funds. And in yesterday's presentation, as well as you reiterated it today, certainly understand that the governor has the legal authority to use the budget reserves before consideration of any unallotment. But does that also legal authority extend to his consideration of how to distribute the CARES Act funds, or is that with due consideration and coordination with the legislature as well?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so we've been working and discussing this issue with the leadership and Chair Carlson, Chair Rosen from the Senate about how best to do that procedure. So the current process, this is a little different with the coronavirus. Thank you. I appreciate that support. If I was home, my dog would be barking right back, I guarantee you. This is a little unusual because typically, as most of you know, when we get a federal fund grant, we don't get the money. What we do is we get the authority and an award once the federal government says you can now utilize this money. And then we go to the legislature to seek approval, appropriation to use that money typically. And so, but that's sort of the normal thing. And generally what we do, the governor puts in his budget that's delivered in or February or March this year, puts in his budget those federal funds that we've been notified are available and we want to use, and then we put it in his budget and we seek authority and appropriation from the legislature. So that's the normal thing. And so we're not used to getting the money first. And it happened, I think, back maybe in 2009. But here, what's happened is after the budget was presented by the governor and after the sort of the deadlines, if you will, for the legislature to make these changes, we received this money. Now I'm talking about the CARES Act money that went directed to, or is being directed to programs versus the coronavirus relief fund. So we have two different streams of revenue generally coming from the federal government, the typical award or grant to an agency for a program, usually following a current formula. And then we also have the direct grant of $2.187 billion directly deposited to the state of Minnesota, and with $317 million of that going to the Hennepin County and Ramsey County. So what we have now is a situation where the $1 billion or so that went directly to the agencies or programs, that process goes through what we call the Legislative Advisory Commission. And so if there's a grant, and we'll talk about that in the next part of this presentation, a little bit about how that's already worked thus far. Then on the other side of this, with the Coronavirus Relief Fund, there's about $1.8 billion in that fund, of which $667 million can be allocated to local units of government. So we have come to the leadership and the legislature saying these are issues that we want to work together to work on. I will say, though, that in the event that we cannot agree or don't get to an agreement, then the normal Legislative Advisory Commission process works, because this money is in a federal account and requires the same sort of level of coordination through the Legislative Advisory Commission process, where we advise the Legislative Advisory Commission of the need to expend this money, and information is sent out, and they have an opportunity to voice their concerns or have a hearing, and if there's any objection, then we can talk about it and get information, but then that money can be directed out of the spending out of that federal account after 10 days if there's not been total agreement prior to that.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Kalambakidis, again, I can't imagine the uncertainty that your forecast suggests. And coming from an economics background as well, I commiserate with you in terms of any correlation, notwithstanding current circumstances. There are no. And when you talk about exceptionally uncertain times, there is no correlation with anything else. But you mentioned with regard to triggers and Chair Garofalo's question, we are coming up on unemployment benefits completing themselves in July. And with regard to the comparison of triggers, that would certainly put a dampener on consumer spending, notwithstanding any other income that they've got coming in. So with regard to unemployment insurance, and we are still under a shelter in place for small businesses, how did you contemplate adding or including that variable into your economic recovery from a statewide basis if we continue to move forward with businesses still being in shutdown mode?
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative. So we, in regarding unemployment insurance benefits specifically, we, IHS produces a forecast of unemployment insurance benefits, and we used that in our modeling. That included the extra $600 a week from the Federal CARES Act. So that was incorporated into, and the timing of that extends into July, but not beyond. So that got incorporated into our forecast for personal income in Minnesota, which subsequently informs our forecast of taxable consumer spending in the sales tax. And so that pattern, so the existence of the unemployment insurance benefits, the pattern of the size of them and the pattern of them, that plays its way through our modeling into through personal income into the sales tax. Then regarding the income tax, we have been receiving very helpful information from Department of Revenue and from DEED about withholding, income tax withholding on those benefits. So we have estimates for that too, so that we could be sure to be capturing the fact that there's income tax. So when people are laid off and they get unemployment insurance benefits, there's still an income tax impact there. Specifically regarding the pattern of lifting restrictions on businesses, what really is the bigger driver in this is how people respond to what they perceive as safe ways to act, safe ways to enter back into economic activity, whether it's businesses or consumers. And so you know, where there are specific timelines of when we know things are going to start opening, that can be incorporated, but it's not a switch. There's a step up of how, you know, how we think things are going to get back to greater activity. And that has to do more with consumer behavior and business behavior than the actual laws.
I might just interject. I'm going to ask members if they can be brief with their questions. We have also the federal funds on the agenda, and we've got 7 or 8 people on the list that have questions. So if members can maybe limit their questions to perhaps one, and we'll try to make sure we get everybody in before we move to the federal funds. Commissioner, what's your timeline? How long can you stay? Because you're going to be part of the federal funds presentation as well.
Right. I'm not sure what the timeline was for this, but I can stay during the duration, assuming it's not all day. But
I figured originally this part of the presentation would be about 9:30, but that's going to be pretty tough to do. We got about 7 or 8 minutes, and we've got about 8 people with questions. So brevity is the key right now, and because I do want to get into the federal funds question as well. Representative Albright, were you done?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll finish there.
Okay, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all for putting this stuff together. I know it's not easy. To Dr. Columbakidis, I know there's been a lot of talk about whether we're going to have a V, a U, or an L-shaped recovery, and I remember asking a question back in February or the March when the February forecast came out about the optimism of actually having an increased surplus at that time. And I was a little concerned with, are we having enough discussions, or have you had discussions with the Council of Economic Advisors? Because it seems to me that you're looking at a V-shaped recovery here. And with all that's going on, and we're only a few months away from that, and we're still in stay at home, I understand the difficulty with making projections and economic assumptions, but I'm just curious how much conversation you had relative to maybe a U or even a slightly upticked L type recovery, because that would significantly affect what we're looking at here relative to your projections.
And maybe if the testifiers can also exercise some brevity, Dr. Columbakidis.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative, we held a meeting, an unusual meeting, not like it was strange, but that we don't normally have in May, with the Council of Economic Advisors as we were preparing our projections so that they could give us their viewpoints of the IHS outlook. And their statement about that is included in our documentation. But let me point out a couple of things, and that is that so they did highlight some places where they thought that IHS might have had too quick a recovery, and some of the council members, it wasn't necessarily consensus, but they talked about the stock market recovery and the corporate profits recovery. IHS had those reaching and exceeding prior pre-pandemic levels next year, and so what we did was we took that. We agreed with that guidance. And so when we used those variables in our forecast, we revised them downward. So we took the advice of the council and the council from the council, and we incorporated that into our outlook. In addition, IHS's outlook was released the first week of April. And so we have had the advantage of watching unemployment insurance claims continue to rise through the next couple of weeks, after the IHS outlook was released. And so we expect that the next release by IHS is going to have a higher level of unemployment than the April one. And so we used that information and we downward revised our forecast or our projection of Minnesota wage and salary income, because we're assuming that the unemployment rate gets higher than what they expected in April. So we have, I would say that our our projection took into consideration the guidance and the caution that we heard from the Council of Economic Advisors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebeling.
Well, add my thanks to those of everyone else here on the call. The question I have, obviously our fate is very tied to what happens in the nation. That's very, very clear. It always is the case. But I'd like to have just a little bit of discussion about to what degree is our fate in our own hands? In other words, what levers do we have here in Minnesota? You mentioned confidence. That's been, you know, consumer confidence. Obviously, this is not about any one policy. But as policymakers, I think we're looking for ways that we can impact this, not just wait for the national atmosphere to improve. So, for example, you know, we have moved forward with testing for the virus. We're going to try to move forward with other kinds of impacts, contact tracing and so on. We're working on that now. But that's my question. To what degree do we have our fate in our own hands? What is maybe the low-hanging fruit, if there is any, that we could do?
Well, Commissioner, that's kind of the $64,000 question in the days ahead, but maybe if you could give a brief response.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. It is a great question. And I think that, you know, as Dr. Klumkitas has said on a number of occasions, it's the federal government that can deficit spend and provide a lot of stimulus and those kinds of things. And they should. And they have been doing some of that, obviously. And we want them to do more. But I think in terms of the state and our own destiny, part of it is the bonding bill is what comes to mind. It's one thing that we typically are to do, that we can do, that really provides more of a long-term opportunity. You know, when we started off this session with a bonding bill proposal, it was knowing that, you know, the job market was sort of, the job market was tight, but we did believe that investing in the infrastructure over the long term was still something we should do. And clearly now, the opportunity for this to be part of our economic recovery package is clear. The question we have to decide is that extra money that we need to spend for the debt service worth the investment? Because we have a deficit, so now obviously we have to fit in a way to pay for that. So that is clearly one idea that we still believe that it's something we would like to pursue with the legislature is a robust bonding bill going forward. But Dr. Klumkitas, do you have any other suggestions that you think in terms of our own fate?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would just reiterate that, this is a math problem, as the commissioner has said. It's a math problem for us, but it's also a human behavior problem. And so we're trying to anticipate how people are going to act and how people are going to react. And regarding both consumer and business confidence, there's a psychological element of how safe do they feel behaving in a certain way. But there's also the means to act. So for consumers, they have to have enough money to get out there and spend. And so some of that has to do with economic variables we can watch, like unemployment and job gains. But some of it is not quite so quantitative. So I guess I would just say, in terms of what can you do or what's in our hands is knowing and acknowledging that it's human beings who are making these decisions and that it matters how they feel about the actions that they're taking.
Representative Liebeling, did that take care of your question? I guess it must have. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the presenters. Two real quick questions. First, under the category of no deed, good deed goes unpunished, what are the odds that the federal government might penalize us for our past good behavior?
Mr. Chair and Representative, well, that's a great phrase. I've learned that phrase. It really has multiple meanings so many times. You know, I hope that doesn't happen. I do think that, you know, as we said, I think we're 47th in terms of the state that gets federal dollars back based on what we send to the federal government in terms of federal payments and stuff. And so you know, we really sort of take care of ourselves, and we're happy to support, you know, the infrastructure of the country in our way. But I'm hoping that, in fact, the next stimulus package is really geared toward, once again, dealing with all states in an equal way and providing opportunities for us to make up for lost revenue. So I think if that principle operates, we should be fine, but you never know.
Well, thank you. A second point has to do with the charts that are being made available. You know, with all this uncertainty, a chart that looked a little more like a hurricane projection chart, where they have, you know, they try to decide where the hurricane's going to hit, but they don't try to put it on a single straight line. They have a kind of funnel-shaped projection that gives us an idea of the range of potential impacts rather than just trying to interpret it as a single line.
Yeah, actually, I think Dr. Columbakidis would be good to talk about the different confidence intervals in this particular forecast from IHS. That's a good point, Representative.
Dr. Columbakidis.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative. So in our the document that we released with this projection, we write about the optimistic and pessimistic scenarios that IHS released, and we did not produce a variety of scenarios on the revenue side. But some things that are interesting about their scenarios this time is that they always assign a subjective probability to a baseline and then a more pessimistic scenario, which in this case has a deeper recession, but not necessarily much, not much longer, a little bit longer. So it still has a pretty robust recovery. And the optimistic scenario has a more shallow recession. So none of them, they all have recessions in them. They assigned a 45% probability to the baseline, which is the one that you saw in the graph. And then a 35% probability to the deeper recession and only a 20% probability to the more shallow recession. That's a low amount of probability to assign to the baseline. So basically they're putting all of their probability on the baseline and the downside. And in the Council of Economic Advisors meeting, we share a graph that shows the path with those three different scenarios. So the IHS in several ways is indicating the degree of volatility in forecasting right now. One is in actual statements in their narrative, but also in the probability that they've assigned to the baseline versus the pessimistic.
Representative Torkelson, was that it? Must have been. Representative Liebling, I asked if you had a follow-up, and I didn't hear anything, so I moved on. Is Representative Liebling still on?
Oh, yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm still here, waving. No, I'm good. Thank you very much.
Okay, very good. Representative Derskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, presenters. Dr. Columbakidis, really draconian and heavy-handed government approach that the governor's shutdown forced on our economy has undoubtedly provided a large degree of what we have in front of us. The question I have is, in your analysis, what date did we use or what date did you use for the lifting of these measures to simulate the graphs, the numbers, et cetera?
Dr. Columbakidis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so there's not a specific date IHS writes in terms of quarters, and that is embedded in our economic forecast is the U.S. economic forecast. We use their forecast to inform ours, and so their pattern is implicit in ours. And so their assumption is that, just to make sure I get it right. So first of all, as I said, the path of the economic data will critically depend on the path of the disease. They expect the spread of COVID-19 to peak and then dissipate in the second calendar quarter of 2020, so that's now, so by early summer, allowing social distancing restrictions to be lifted during the third quarter, so late summer or early fall, and economic recovery begins then.
So Dr. Columbakidis, were there any Minnesota specific nuances to that to that information that you made? I mean, obviously, if we lift the stay at home order and let people go back to work today, it's going to be different in Minnesota than if we wait until the end of July. What can you say about that? And then I've got one more question.
Well, I was trying to limit people to one basic question because we've got several on the list, but Dr. Columbakidis.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, where, as I said earlier, where there are specific, specific kinds of taxes that depend on specific kinds of restrictions, we can incorporate that. But even when we assume restrictions are lifted, what matters more in the outlook is how people gradually move to what might be whatever the new normal is. And so the path of the economic activity, both the downturn and the recovery, depends more on how people act and less on when and how the governments change restrictions.
Well, Mr. Chair and Dr. Columbakidis, so we have somewhere in the neighborhood of, Doctor, maybe you can tell us what it is, somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 or 25% unemployment here in Minnesota right now. The state of South Dakota, I am told, that did not shut down, has somewhere in the neighborhood of 8% unemployment. So the differences there, Doctor, are stark. And so I would expect, had we taken their path, instead of the one we have, we wouldn't have as even close to as severe of a recession and the resulting economic or budgetary issues that we're discussing today. What would you say to that?
Mr. Chair, let me jump in here for a moment. I think one of the things that you have to realize in this situation is that the policies that Governor Walz is following is based upon health, the Minnesota Department of Health and other advice about saving lives, about flattening the curve, having enough PPE, personal protective equipment available, having critical care available, ICU units available. So the driving factor is not simply a numbers game. The driving factor is how do you save the most lives? How do you provide the most opportunity for people to get through this in a way that minimizes the loss of life and minimizes the disruption to the economy at the same time? It's a balancing act. And to suggest that you simply keep your eye on the economic model without taking into account the medical model, the concern about the direction and path of this pandemic, I think would not be an adequate understanding of what Governor Walz is currently engaged in.
Well, I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, if Dr. Columbakidis would respond. And Commissioner, with all due respect, we're talking about the economic impact side here today. And I think we all know that in the public policy arena that that's part of the discussion. Certainly that's the governor's job to discuss both sides of those. It's certainly our legislative job to describe both sides of those. And today we're talking about the economic side. So I'm curious, had we taken a path like South Dakota instead of the one that we did, how much different would this budget scenario and the drastic decrease in state revenue have been affected?
Just a final comment, Dr. Columbakidis, was directed to you, but if you could be brief, and then we'll move on to Representative Knorr. Dr. Columbakidis.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative, we will never know how things might have been different in Minnesota or South Dakota, depending on different paths of the disease and different choices. We didn't take Minnesota and run a control experiment with exactly the same economy and exactly the same circumstances, exactly the same people and different policies. And so what I will reiterate what I said, what I've said before, which is that we are looking at how people will react and how consumers and businesses will react as the disease plays out and as the economy changes. And that is how the path of the economic projection has been constructed.
Okay, Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Thank you all. I just wanted to know the pathway for small business, especially the service industry, which has been hit the hardest. What role do we have as a state in terms of uplifting the service industry to get back to the recovery path? So what role can we play as a state, if there is any?
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, you're voicing a concern that really is a hard one. I think that as we talked a little bit about yesterday, this pandemic, it really affects different communities differently, and it really, in some cases, really heightens some of the difficulties that some industries are experiencing. I think one of the things that Dr. Klimakidis has made clear, it's you can do all kinds of actions and notices, but it's really how do you restore the confidence of people to return to work and to do that. I know that Commissioner Grove has been working really hard in working on how to provide economic security while also maintaining a safe reopening. And so they've been putting out a lot of materials to help small businesses learn how to certify and make clear to their employees and to the people that work there that they have a safe work environment, and that they're doing it in a way that can provide some economic opportunity, but also in a way that maintains social distancing and all those safe requirements, whether you might need to have PPE, personal protective equipment, or not. So I think his committee, Commissioner Grove's committee, has been working really diligently with the Department of Health to come up with guidelines so that all businesses can take a look at what do they need to do to safely put people back to work. And I think the key is working together to make sure that if everyone has that same confidence level, if they go into a place of business and they know that there's masks being worn or social distancing is practicing, I think to the extent we can provide that confidence to people, they will start returning. So but it is hard. The people in the service, you know, the service business is person to person generally, right? And so how do you do that in a way that makes it safe? So anyway, Commissioner Grove and his team is working really hard on the economic security and safe reopening process.
Representative Nard, did that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's
okay. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my question will be directed to Dr. Klimakidis. But first, I wanted to thank Representative Liebling for her comments. Representative, I agree with you. I think that Minnesota has always been an outlier with regard to its performance nationally. And I think with regard to consumer confidence, which we've been talking about in these last two discussions, the thing that is really important for all of us to demonstrate is to rise above the partisanship, especially in this committee as well, and to be working together to offer consumers that sense of confidence that the legislature and the governor are working together so that they can have some sense of when this is going to end. More than 60%, nearly 70% of Minnesotans think that the legislature and the governor should be working closely together and not acting unilaterally. To my question, Mr. Chair, Doctor, I note that the wage income is the largest factor or largest impacted, and you show it on your graph as an annual change of negative 5.9%. And I'd like to ask you a little bit about the assumptions that you used around that. I note that the Federal CARES Act, the $600 supplemental unemployment compensation income to most workers, as well as our unemployment, is taxable income. So many people have expressed to me that they're nearly whole with regard to their monthly income by this help that was enacted by the federal government. So that money runs out in July. Do you have some specific assumptions with regard to wage and salary income that people will be fully back to work at some certain point in time, or is there some expectation there will be a second CARES Act and additional monies for people? And because this was listed as wage and salary disbursements, are you including in wage and salary disbursements the revenue that would normally be of small businesses who generally are organized differently than individual income? So if you could just comment on how you came up with that relatively modest number of only 5% off, given that 25% of the population is unemployed right now.
Commissioner?
I think Guy can jump in on that one, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, do this backwards, I think. Our forecast or projection for total wage and salary income does not include business income. That's a separate projection. That projection was also lowered, but I don't recall the percentage. So that's not in that 5.9% projected decline that you saw, but we do forecast that separately in the income tax. The unemployment insurance benefits, both the state and the additional $600 per week from the federal government is incorporated into into the income tax forecast. But if I recall correctly, that is not included in that wage and salary income variable. That's a separate line that we project. So we project the wages and salaries. So if you think about the income tax and all the types of income that get taxed, we project each of those lines independently. And so the unemployment insurance benefits gets projected, the business income that gets taxed under the income tax gets projected, and wage and salary income gets projected as well.
So, Mr. Chair,
final question then, because we're going to go to the next item on the agenda. Representative.
Thank you. So just to be clear, I mean, most sub-S and LLC income, although it's corporate, flows through to the individual and is usually reported as individual income. So I was trying to be clear about the distinction of what truly is corporate income versus small business income. Because I think most of that and many of our small entrepreneurs are organized that way. There's 465,000 small businesses in Minnesota that are organized as such. And so I just wanted to make sure that they were actually included in individual income, or are you still putting that as corporate income?
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. So the pass-through income gets taxed under the individual income tax is projected under the individual income tax projection. And so we project partnership income, sole proprietorship income, S-Corp, LLC income, and then the C-corporations are taxed under the corporate franchise tax, and we project that separately. And that one is driven by a forecast for corporate profits. So that's a separate projection.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that clarification.
Yep, thank you. Well, now we made it through the list, and I thank members for trying to shorten up their questions a bit. So that we could get to the next item on the agenda, which is the federal funds and the work groups. So, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, thanks for putting up the slide deck. So we have a lot of material to cover here. So I'm going to go somewhat fast, at least initially, to kind of
get... That's what I've been pressing on the last group to kind of be brief.
I'll try to move it along, because we want to do the federal fund overview, and we also want to talk about the working group that we've been engaged in here in the administration. So first of all, this was on the slide deck that I gave out yesterday, but I think one of the things we all need to be aware of and situationally aware of, and that is that this, not only is this a difficult budget situation in general, but we also have the added complexity of the federal funds interfacing or interworking with state funds and our state funds and where those dollars are going. There's also private dollars that are involved here. But you can see on the right side of this, these are where the money is going to. So the federal money has been Some of that has been delivered to the state of Minnesota, as I mentioned earlier, some of it in the coronavirus relief fund as a amount deposited that we can use for COVID-19 response as a reimbursement. And some of it is geared towards specific programs. FEMA funding is a problem. We'll talk a little bit about that on a separate slide. And then as we'll go through the state investments so far. So if we can go to the next slide, we can talk a little bit about all the Budget Director Raton kind of explained where we are today in the state resources. And she mentioned this earlier in the investments that we've already made and part of our budget appropriated this year. Budget Director Raton. And if you're like me, you might be on mute.
There we go. Sorry about that.
That's right. So
this slide shows the state resources that have been appropriated to date for COVID response. It shows the total amount that was appropriated, the amount that has been spent or encumbered to date, and the amount that remains unspent. The biggest pot of money that is remaining unspent is the healthcare response fund. That is because the Department of Health has a application process out there for healthcare providers. They did an application process and allocation of the first $50 million that was available for similar purposes in the public health contingency account first, and now they are going through my understanding is over $600 million in requests that came in response to that solicitation for the $150 million. But this slide just provides an overview of the balances in the appropriations that have been made to date from state funding sources. If you turn to the next slide gives some more detail about the COVID Minnesota Fund in particular. And if you recall, the COVID Minnesota Fund is the flexible pot of resources that can be used for response to COVID. For allocations that are over $1 million, we are going through the LCRC process, which is we provide that recommendation to members of the legislature to review and give their feedback and approval. So to date, out of the COVID Minnesota Fund, nearly $126 million has been allocated. Of that amount, we've spent or encumbered about $100 million of it. $100 million remains unspent. There is a pot that has been allocated for PPE purchases. $12.5 million of that remains available. We asked for a flexible spending pot for personal protective equipment because of how the marketplace is working right now. We don't have time to do requests for every purchase over $1 million and wait for a response from the LCRC. Given the market conditions, we need to act quickly when we see PPE available on the market. And this is purchasing that Commissioner Roberts Davis is overseeing along with some private sector partners. Listed here are some of the larger purchases or allocations made to date. We've spent $13.7 million on ventilators and BiPAP machines, which are a similar device to ventilators. We've allocated or spent up to over $60 million on personal protective equipment and other medical supplies. There was $36 million for the testing contracts with the U of M and Mayo. About $2.2 million of operating support for the direct response to COVID within our prison system for the Department of Corrections. $1.8 million was allocated for a preparation of an alternative care site in Roseville. And then just this week, $11 million was allocated for the disposal of animal carcasses. This is in response to the critical situation with hogs in southern Minnesota. With this fund, legislative reports are issued twice a month. We provided reports on April 15th and April 30th that provided detailed information about all the spending made so far and the requests so far from the COVID Minnesota Fund. Really important to note that any money that is continuing to be unobligated in the fund on May 11th, which is just now 5 days away, canceled back to the general fund. So to have this fund continue, that language would need to be removed. If we turn to the next slide. Commissioner France, do you want to talk a bit about this? This is about federal funds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go over this slide and reiterate what Budget Director Raitan said, that the May 11th expiration date for the COVID Minnesota Fund is a looming problem. We anticipate we continue to authorize and get approval to spend out of that. And as I'm sitting here, I'm getting more and more requests. We do not anticipate all that money will be spent by the May 11th. In fact, we believe it should be more money should be put into that. So we are making a request that the May 11th date be eliminated and additional monies we think being restored to the $200 million level is appropriate and the wise thing to do. So those are two things on our request list. This particular request though I want to talk about is the other money, the money that I mentioned earlier that goes directly to agencies and programs from the federal government, where we get a grant, and then after we're awarded the information, we send this to the LAC, the Legislative Advisory Commission. As you all know, the Legislative Advisory Commission changes based upon the nature of the request. In some cases, for MnDOT, for example, the Legislative Advisory Commission members included the Majority Leader of the Senate, the Chair of the Finance Committee, and the Chair of the Transportation Finance Committee. And in the House, it was the Speaker, the Chair Carlson in the Ways and Means, and Frank Hornstein, the Chair of the Transportation Finance Committee. So in this case, we submitted on April 25th these six requests that we believed really needed immediate attention. We prefer, obviously, to, whenever possible and we have time, to submit these for the normal legislative process. But these were all monies that had been awarded and were ready to be distributed. There was very little, if any, discretion in these funds. They were really prepared for formulas that were already in existence. And for example, the Older Americans, the first one under the DHS was for funding to rural hospitals to provide protect patients, staff, and provide lab testing and hospital staffing to respond to this emergency. We thought that money needed to get out right away. The second one was for emerging infections program for surveillance and reporting. Once again, we felt this was important to get out as quickly as possible. The two in the Minnesota Department of Health, one was for the emerging infection program to help with the home delivered. Do I have this right? Oh, I'm sorry. I've switched these around. I'm reading from a paper that's different. So I'm sorry. I'm now on the DHS, the MDH for the programs I mentioned about, and in terms of providing those programs, the DHS was for congregate meals and for the home delivered meals. These obviously were programs we felt needed to be supported right away. The MnDOT programs were a little different in this situation. The MnDOT was the first one was for an airport improvement program. This was to allow airports to receive this funding in order to maintain the airports and also to help support their operations during this economic situation. And the last one was a formula grants for rural transit. Again, another important need as determined by Congress to get out as quick as possible. So those requests were made last April 25th and were approved within a matter of several days. And those funds were being worked on now to get distributed. So I just wanted to give a little bit more insight in terms of how the LAC process has worked and we think will continue to work. I think we're ready to go to the next slide. I'll let Budget Director Raitan explain this in great detail, right, Budget Director Raitan?
Sure. So these are the additional grants we are expecting to come to the state of Minnesota. Many of these will be approved through the existing LAC process. That is typically how we process federal grants that come to us in these sorts of urgent situations where they are provided and need to be spent quickly. Some of these dollars will not go through the LAC process because some entities receive them directly and have statutory authority in law to receive and spend them. Some examples would be the University of Minnesota funding, the Minnesota State funding, as well as the Met Council funding for transit grants. But there is you can reach out to the agencies for more details on these grants, but then as we receive them, we will be sending them through the LAC, and we can't make those submissions until we actually receive the federal award. And then if we turn to the next slide, this is a view of some of the federal funds that have been allocated within the state of Minnesota, but are not flowing through state government. In some cases, these are going directly to local units of government. An example would be the Coronavirus Relief Fund dollars that went directly to Hennepin and Ramsey County, but there's other specific grants that go directly to locals instead of flowing through a state agency. There's also grants in here that are going directly, for example, to healthcare providers. Example, the Hospital Preparedness Program and Response Activities. There's also grants directly to community health centers in here. And then there's also grants to individuals and businesses, such as the Paycheck Protection Program, as well as the direct stimulus payments to individuals in the state of Minnesota. We don't necessarily have comprehensive data here because we don't have visibility to all of this money that's flowing directly from the federal government to other entities. But where we do have data available, either because it's published at the federal level about what states it's going to, or we have some other data source, for example, the federal funds information for the state's organization does some tracking and provides us with this data. We've provided it here for you. So turning to the next slide, this slide gives some overview of the Coronavirus Relief Fund. And when we've talked about the federal money that's coming from the CARES Act, this has kind of been where the conversation has focused. The Coronavirus Relief Fund is relatively flexible money that states can use to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. Minnesota as a state has a total allocation of $2.187 billion. The actual state of Minnesota, as a government, received the $1.87 billion. Hennepin and Ramsey County received a portion directly, the $317 million, and that's because they're local units of government with over 500,000 in population. And those entities were allowed to apply directly to the federal government for a share of the state allocation. But then Minnesota can determine how much we will pass through to other local units of government. And Commissioner Franz has already made that request to the legislature to work in partnership in determining how we do this allocation. The federal formula for the CARES Act talked about up to 45% of the total state allocation being available for local units of government, but the state is not required to pass through that amount, nor are we limited by that amount. But if we did use that amount as a placeholder, that would be $667 million in additional funding from the $1.87 billion pot for local units of government. Just at a high level, these funds can be used for medical expenses, public health expenses, payroll expenses that are due to COVID. Expenses for actions to facilitate compliance, and as well as expenses associated with the provision of economic support in connection to the COVID pandemic. We have been waiting for additional federal guidance. I would say we got the clearest federal guidance to date yesterday from the Department of Treasury. They provided a much more robust frequently asked questions document yesterday, which has provided us a better sense of how these dollars can and can't be used. So we're better positioned now than we had been in weeks prior to have conversations about how these funds are used. If we turn to the next slide.
Let me just interject real quick, Budget Director Raton. So as we get into the next slide, one of the things that Commissioner Bowerly will be leading our efforts to work with the legislature, and she's coordinating with him now about ways to provide oversight and help figure out the correct and equitable way to distribute this money. So just wanted to mention that. Thank you. Go ahead, Britta.
So Commissioner Franz mentioned earlier, there is some complexity with the FEMA dollars associated with our COVID response. So FEMA requires a state match for anytime we seek FEMA reimbursement. But there's a number of our activities that we are already doing that could be eligible in whole or in part for FEMA reimbursement. So FEMA, under the CARES Act, they put $45 billion into the FEMA Disaster Relief Fund. $45 billion is available nationally. It can be used for state governments, for local governments, but also for tribes and private nonprofits. So all of those entities can be applying for FEMA reimbursement. Some examples of the expenditures that are eligible for FEMA reimbursement are listed here. The management in response to the immediate threats. So entities like our State Emergency Operations Center, emergency medical care supplies and equipment, transport of those supplies and individuals, as well as medical sheltering. That's a piece that we've talked about in quite a bit of detail in terms of providing sheltering for people that need isolation who have either tested positive for COVID or have been exposed to someone who has. So as I mentioned, these funds are provided on a reimbursement basis. So we have to spend state dollars first and then seek reimbursement from FEMA. We are looking at some of our COVID Minnesota dollars that we've spent to date, as well as some of the other appropriations made to assess whether they are FEMA eligible. A number of our COVID Minnesota fund expenditures, such as the alternative care site we've set up, the PPE that's been purchased, the ventilators that have been purchased, are very likely eligible as FEMA reimbursable expenditures. So we need to make decisions about, do we seek FEMA reimbursement or do we apply those costs against the COVID or the Coronavirus Relief Fund? So the Coronavirus Relief Fund provides 100% federal, the federal government covers 100% of the cost, FEMA covers 75%. But to maximize our federal dollars, we might want to do a blend of both. One, applying things to the Coronavirus Relief Fund, and two, also seeking FEMA reimbursement where it makes sense, because that would maximize our available federal funds. The other thing that I think is just really important to highlight is that under current law, the Disaster Assistance Contingency Account covers the 25% non-federal share for state government, but also local governments. So local governments throughout the state will likely be applying to FEMA as part of this declared disaster. Our past practice for about the past decade is that the state covers the entire state and local share. That could be quite expensive in this emergency. We don't know yet the scope of what those costs will be at the local government level. We have $30 million in the Disaster Assistant Contingency Account to cover that 25% match, but I'm assuming that the costs that locals will be providing for FEMA reimbursement will far exceed that dollar amount. So that may be a discussion we need to have about to what degree the state covers that state and local share. Prior to the passage of the Disaster Assistance Contingency Account, the state didn't always cover the full 25%. We sometimes covered just a portion of it, and it varied based on the disaster. And then we can turn to the next slide. This was just a reminder of the governor's current supplemental budget. These are the asks to date. What's highlighted here are the asks that have not been funded through the legislature to date for COVID response. We also have listed here the governor's remaining supplemental budget proposals that were pre the COVID pandemic, well, not quite pre, but right towards the beginning of the COVID pandemic. So they're a little bit broader, as well as the general fund cost of the governor's existing bonding proposal. Commissioner Franz, I can turn it to you for the remainder.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and just to Representative Garofalo's earlier question, I mean, obviously what we will be doing is looking at the current budget projection in light of the budget recommendations the governor's made and figuring out ways to to solve all the various problems and look at some of these needs. A lot of those needs haven't changed. In fact, some of them have been exacerbated. But so there's a lot of there are a lot of issues to resolve before we get out of session from our point of view. So let's talk a little bit about the organizing the COVID-19 work. I was talking earlier, joking about my getting a day off, but let me just tell you that I will say the folks who are working on these different groups are literally working night and day. One of the things that we started right away under the direction of Chris Schmidt, the chief of staff, was to get organized in the different areas so that we could, we were obviously, if you recall, you know, a month ago, 6 weeks ago, the concern about not knowing when the surge was going to happen. How big would the surge be and when is it going to happen? We've clearly been doing a lot of work on modeling and trying to figure that out, trying to be ready, but both in terms of capacity, supplies, and testing that we've talked a little bit about. So the idea was, well, let's, what should the response be? And then we needed to figure out how to recover from this and come up with strategies to really help us get through this situation as best we can. And we need, then, in order to do that, we obviously had to have resources. And that's where we've worked with the legislature, for example, for the Minnesota fund, the COVID-19 Minnesota fund, as was one of the early ways we did that. We did that with a public contingency health account at the Department of Health. So we've already partnered for over about $550 million worth of investments in some of these areas. But we also now have federal funds and private sector identity funds that we want to use collectively. So this just sort of shows you the organizing principles that we engaged in. And I want to talk, I want to walk through some of the working groups that we're working with. I've got Director Kelly on the line with me. We'll do kind of a tag team here. What I'll do is we'll quickly go through the different working groups, kind of what they're doing, and Director Kelly can give an example or two. But if you turn to the next slide where you see the, see if I have the right one, yes. So here, this was the initial concern was, how do we work with the hospitals to make sure that we have the right bed capacity and the right ICU and the right workforce? It's a complicated arrangement based upon what the forecasting is, the modeling shows. And the modeling obviously is changing and day to day, but we've been working really hard to make sure that we're standing up. In fact, I think, Director Kelly, if you could talk a little bit about the alternative care site as one of those projects we're working on.
Yes, good morning. If you can hear me, Mr. Chair and members, and apparently I've pushed enough buttons to solve my tech problem. But good morning. For the record, my name is Joe Kelly. I'm the director of the state's Emergency Management Division with the Department of Public Safety. And currently I'm working with my colleague from the Department of Health to lead the effort in the State Emergency Operations Center. As Commissioner Franz alluded to, This is a very unusual disaster. I've been in public service for now 40 years this week and have participated both in the military and now in state service, more than 50 separate disasters, and I've never seen anything like this. Certainly what the governor's chief of staff did in organizing this work groups, these work groups enabled us to do this work without that augmentation of a lot of talented people and a lot of effort, we wouldn't be there where we are today, and the health surge that the commissioner mentioned is one of those key areas. We have a lot of confidence that the time that some of these stay-at-home measures and the social distancing have bought us have allowed the hospitals themselves on their properties to develop additional surge capacity, whether it's the doubling, more than doubling their intensive care unit capacity to adding another 700 general purpose beds. But we have also recognized that if the healthcare system is overcome by the demands of the response, we had to have a relief valve for them. So we worked with the Department of Health, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the National Guard to identify sites around the state of Minnesota that could be what we call alternate care sites. And we've identified all of those. We hope we never have to use them. They're not COVID hospitals. They are basically overflow. They would take people out of the existing hospitals that are not COVID patients to free up space in the hospitals for more for those more critically ill. And as Commissioner Franz alluded to, we are in the process of making modifications to a site in Roseville that would serve as that. We are not going to build them all out at once. We don't think that's smart. We have watched other states spend millions, tens of millions of dollars on facilities that were never used or only lightly used. We're going to build them and stand up that capability as we need them. But the healthcare surge has really been a remarkable effort to this point. So, Commissioner or Mr. Chair?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Director Kelly. Then the next one I want to talk a little bit about is the supplies. Now, Budget Director Raton described sort of the product and what we've been able to purchase over the last several months. But Commissioner Robert Stavis worked and collaborated with several private partners, including in particular Ecolab, who really helped loan some professionals that are in the supply chain profession. That's what they do. And this is really a supply chain problem. And so Commissioner Robert Stavis, with the assistance of Dr. John Hicks, has been deciding what are those critical things and how quickly can we purchase them and get them to a location so we have them available. And I get several requests every day that are coming through that she's working on. And, it's really a challenge. And it's really, as Director Kelly mentioned, it's part of this strategy to be ready for whatever comes our way. And I think everyone knows that we don't have enough PPE in general yet. And it's not something specific to Minnesota. It's just a problem. So real kudos to Commissioner Robert Stavis and the work that her team is doing there. The next one I'll mention is testing. And as you all know, and the Representative Liebling talked a little bit about this in the vein of charting our own course and sort of how do we do that. One of the ways we do that is through testing. By getting smarter and more accurate information, we can figure out what's happening with the path of this pandemic. And so the historic agreement with the University of Minnesota Mayo provides an opportunity for development and testing capacity that would get to about 15,000 serological tests a day and about 20,000 PCR tests a day. So that's where we've already increased that daily count dramatically, but we're working toward that goal in phase one. This was a phase one development contract to get things up and running, to make sure that we had a testing command center that was manned, persons there from the U, from Mayo, from the Department of Health, and all the health systems, to make sure that we're following where the outbreak is happening, where do we need to test, and how can we do that in a way that really facilitates quick testing, quick results, and then follow up with the contact tracing that we're now working on to supplement that. So, Director Kelly, anything you want to add about testing?
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Director Kelly.
Just a couple of things in addition to the numbers that Commissioner Franz mentioned. The governor gave us a target of 5,000 tests per day as one of those things that would tell us that we're getting to the point where we can start to loosen some of the restrictions. Today we're within a handful of that 5,000, so I think we're well on that path. The other is for the demand for testing statewide, and we now have over 200 testing facilities have been established around the state, and well past 90% of Minnesotans live within 30 miles of having a test site available to them. So a tremendous amount of progress has been made, and as we've heard the healthcare professionals and the governor mentioned many times, testing is absolutely essential to the path forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director Kelly. And then the last one on this page, education and childcare. We all know that the challenges that we've had with distance learning, providing care for the kids of workers in critical sectors. This group has been working more than overtime, nonstop, to help provide childcare workers with support, to help the schools and their transitioning. The Department of Education and our Children's Cabinet Group have worked so hard together to coordinate this, and it's an ongoing issue. And now we need to start thinking, and they're planning for what happens this summer. So if you go to the next slide, this would be our last slide. And sorry, we're almost out of time. I want to mention just a couple of other groups. The at-risk populations, clearly, and one of the concerns we have is that how do we support those people most vulnerable to COVID-19. The next one is about food. There are a lot of folks with food insecurities. We've been working with food shelves around the country, around the state, trying to make sure that those people who need the most in need have food to eat. The economic and security and safe reopening has been under Commissioner Grove, has been working really hard on that issue, along with Commissioner Lepink and Commissioner Terry Tomes, in terms of trying to figure out a way to open up the economy that's safe, that provides workers and customers and all of us with that opportunity to enhance and increase economic activity, but in a safe way and not to generate an unusual outbreak. So social distancing is something they're working on a lot. I want to talk about the last one, community resiliency, but I wanted to go back to Director Kelly. I went over those fairly quickly. Anything you want to mention about any one of those three?
Director Kelly?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Yeah, I would just say on the at-risk populations, sometimes that get cast as just, you know, taking care of people who are experiencing homelessness. And if they test positive, they don't have the ability to go shelter at home because they don't have one. But it's really much broader than that. And I would just point to Nobles County and the pork processing plant down in Worthington. They had a lot of, I think we're now up to 700 or 800 of those workers tested positive. Many of them are in living arrangements where they can't go home because going home with that living arrangement would put them in the position that they would potentially infect their household mate. So this really does apply to everybody with underlying health conditions as well as age and living arrangements. So there's been some really good work done there, especially at the local level. I give a lot of credit to local public health as well as local emergency management from trying to keep everybody safe and prevent and minimize the amount of community spread that's happening in our communities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director Kelly. Yeah, the last one I'll mention is community resiliency, and that is recently been an activated working group, and Commissioner Lucero is directing that effort, because one of the things that we've found is that equity has to be considered in what's happening with our response to COVID-19. We're finding that this pandemic is being quite cruel and exacerbating some of the inequities that we all have already experienced, and we really wanted Commissioner Lucero to take this on and help develop a work plan and some key metrics so us to find out and figure out what can we do to help in these areas to make sure that we identify communities that are being adversely and inequitably affected by COVID-19, don't have the resources or opportunities that we fully think they should have. So it's both health and financial inequity. So a lot of credit to her and the team that are working on that just in the last week or so. So I guess the last page really talks about and I'm going over these so fast. I'm not doing nearly doing a disservice to all these groups, as Director Kelly knows. There's so much going on, and we could testify all day long about the different activities and the programs we're coming up to. But in the final analysis on the resource page, we really need to work with the legislature and the federal government to manage these state and federal funds to respond effectively. We want to make sure that we do this quickly, and we supply the need and respond to the need, but do so in a transparent way. That's one of the reasons why twice a month we report out all the expenditures from the Minnesota COVID, the Minnesota Fund, showing where every dollar has been spent, what's been purchased, and we want to continue that transparency in all these working groups. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry we went through a lot of stuff really quickly, but I wanted to get through it all. Thank you.
That's fine. It was an ambitious agenda, Commissioner. We have four members that have indicated they have questions, and I'll ask them if they could just go right to their question and maybe keep the background information to a minimum so that all four get a chance to get their questions in and we can adjourn in a timely manner. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for this presentation. I had two questions, but I'm just going to ask one of them, and that has to do with the federal guidance that you got yesterday and whether or not you have any level of comfort based on that, whether the work comp bill that we passed a few weeks ago in the legislature, we passed a bill to cover frontline workers who had to miss work because they contracted COVID, and we didn't fund that bill. And I'm wondering if you think that the funds for that, those expenses could be used, if the federal funds could be used to cover those expenses.
Mr. Chair, Representative, great question. I'm going to Budget Director Raton. I have not had a chance to look at those the new guidance yet. Budget Director Raton, do we have a feeling about that yet?
Director Raton.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, yes, the guidance actually spoke directly to that. Workers' comp costs by governments are a eligible use of that fund. So yes, it is something we can look at to fund the workers' comp costs incurred by the state. One piece of complexity about the coronavirus relief fund is all spending needs to happen by the end of this calendar year, by December 30th, 2020. So our estimates for the workers' comp costs that we were talking about when that bill was passed was for a longer time frame than just to the end of the year. So we would need to have an estimate of the costs that we would incur through the end of this calendar year to be able to apply those costs against the coronavirus relief fund.
Thank you for that answer, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I do believe, too, that I've heard recently, and I don't remember where, but that there's not going to be nearly as many cases where we're going to be needing to use those funds as this thing wasn't, as horrible as anticipated. So thank you for that answer.
Representative Bernardi. Representative Bernardi.
I'm back. Thank you. Sorry.
Oh, Bernardi.
Okay. My question is, and thank you for the presentation today. I want to be clear on the part regarding federal guidance to for the money that came to the state and to Ramsey and Hennepin County. I understand the state has the discretion to pass some on to local governments. What is the federal guidance for those two counties? I want to be clear on the pathways for our locals to get some resources.
Let me, Mr. Chair, let me start, then I'll ask Budget Director Raitan to give some more detail. So you're right. So the direct allocation of the $317 million to both Ramsey and Hennepin County was a direct contribution from the Treasury to those particular counties. And the other remaining $667 million may be distributed to local units of government as determined by the state, meaning we need to figure out how to do that equitably and under what guidelines. And I'll let Budget Director Raitan talk a little bit about what we know now about what the direction is to local units of government to spend that money.
Budget Director Raitan. You're not live.
I can hear her talking next door. It's just that I wondered why it was muffled all of a sudden.
I have to remember to unmute on my phone and my computer since I called in, and apparently that's too hard for me. So the local units of government have the same guidance as the state has in terms of the allowable uses of the fund. So the same guidance applies. One complicating factor that we need to wade through is that we as a state, because we are granting it out to the local units, or if we choose to grant it out to the local units, we need to ensure that they are spending on those eligible uses. And so we need to have some oversight of the local spending and what they're using it for to ensure that it's in compliance with that same guidance that we have as a state in terms of what are eligible uses of the fund.
Okay.
Representative Bernardi, did that?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one clarifying question. So the money that the counties receive, there is no expectation that that will be passed on to the locals. That is for the counties for their use. I want to verify that.
Representative Bernardi, the guidance does speak explicitly to that, and they are not required to pass it to other units within their jurisdiction.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bernardi answered one of my questions. The other question is directed to Budget Director Raitan. Also, you mentioned the 45% allocation to local governments, which we just covered. Then there was the other state paying up to 25% of local matching funds, I believe that was FEMA dollars. Are the school districts eligible for this money as well as a local government unit?
Director Raitan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, the school districts, I believe, could receive money passed through through the Coronavirus Relief Fund from the state if the state decided to do that. If Joe Kelly is still on, Joe could maybe answer whether school districts are an eligible entity to file for FEMA. My assumption is that they are, but I would like Joe Kelly to confirm that if he's still on.
Mr. Kelly, are you still with us?
I still am, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you. The school districts are eligible applicants for FEMA assistance. The tricky part, and it's not even tricky, the part that has to be done would be to make sure that what they're asking reimbursement for is eligible from FEMA, and it's not just for some other, not for some other extraordinary costs or losses, but school districts certainly are eligible to apply for FEMA assistance. That is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I've gotten messages from a number of school districts that their fee-based type of revenue has been interrupted by COVID and are facing a financial impact. So that might be something that's applicable. And the last comment I would just quickly make is that, Director Kelly, I have received a number of emails over this past weekend from past enlisted members, constituents, and it comes with high praise and accolades for both your talent and your leadership. And thank you for working smart and welcome aboard.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Director Rattan.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I just want to clarify that the loss of revenue from the Coronavirus Relief Fund, that's a specifically prohibited use of the Coronavirus Relief Fund, which is making the use of that fund somewhat tricky for all units of government, because one of the biggest budgetary impacts is that loss of revenue, and the Coronavirus Relief Fund cannot be used to replace lost revenue. It needs to be used to pay directly costs for the response to COVID.
Good, thank you.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is to the $550 million that has been spent already by the state on COVID-related matters. With the additional guidance that we received from the federal government, does that give us enough guidance at this point to know whether all of that money is reimbursable, and such that the decision point right now is whether we're spending CARES money or getting FEMA reimbursement, or is there still additional federal guidance that we need to make that determination?
Would that be
Mr. Chair? Yeah, Mr. Chair, I got to be careful what I say on the record here, I suppose. but, you know, more guidance is always better. And it's been hard to come by. Frankly, we do feel better about what we've learned. And it's helpful to us. There are still some nuances that we're working through. But I do think it gives us a better sense of how to proceed. And we'll be making some recommendations about that going forward. But it did help. Budget Director Rattan, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Commissioner Franz, Mr. Chair, I would say yes. It provided some more clarity. The question about whether we pursue FEMA or pursue coronavirus relief funds, I think, is the biggest question we're wrestling with right now, and where to advise with which pot of money. There are some complexities with the December 30th end date on the coronavirus relief fund. A lot of the general fund dollars that were made available in Chapter 71 have an end date that goes out well past December 30th. So the question we have right now is, can we get that money spent by that end date, or is that not possible? And if it's not possible, then it would be difficult to use the coronavirus relief fund. And then, of course, many things then are not eligible for FEMA because they're not an eligible expense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The final question, because we are in overtime already, Representative Albright, you've got the last one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is for Director Kelly. Director Kelly, I'm sure you're well aware it's been in the news about the agricultural situation out west with just the devastation to the Agriculture Committee with regard to hog production. I'm just wondering if you could relate any possibility that Chapter 12 might have to that situation and what we might be able to provide to our ag community with relief in light of what we did for the avian flu with the turkey farmers. I'm just wondering if there's any applicability with Chapter 12 to what's going on with hog populations.
Mr. Chair? Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, and I'll let Commissioner Franz kind of fill in behind with the, I think it's around $11 million for ag relief. We have been working hard with FEMA on the issue, and there are several, some for FEMA, some for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and of course our Minnesota Department of Agriculture. There's the costs of destroying, depopulating the herds, and there's costs of disposing of the hogs that can't go to market. At this point in time, I'll talk about the federal and then I'll get to your direct question, Representative. At this point in time, FEMA is saying that under their declaration, the destruction is not eligible. They are considering whether to make an exception and make disposal eligible, but I am not optimistic about that. Within Chapter 12, I think the legislature in Chapter 12A could give themselves some discretion, either under the provisions that talk about things that aren't funded by, reimbursed by FEMA, and to create a special appropriation in the agriculture section of Chapter 12A, which I like to give the short title of supplemental disaster assistance for things that aren't covered by the federal government or other state programs.
Yeah, let me add, Mr. Chair, we have just approved a request for almost $11 million, as Director Kelly mentioned. It just got approved, I think it was yesterday, or Monday, to supplement that with the Minnesota Fund, the COVID-19 Minnesota Fund. So those were state dollars that we directed to implement that emergency program. It does bring back the point that I first met Director Kelly in 2015 during the avian flu crisis. And I admire, I think Director Kelly is a great guy and a talented public servant, but actually I will tell you, I never wanted to work with him again after the avian bird flu crisis. I thought, that's enough. One crisis is enough for me. So I'm sorry we're working together again, Director Kelly, but I really do appreciate your service and thank you for all you do.
Mr. Chair?
I assume some of that was tongue-in-cheek, Commissioner. Director Kelly?
If I could make one follow-up, because Representative Albright's question and making that comparison back to the avian influenza, that's where the rub is here, because the Department of Agriculture, their programs are built around animal diseases, and clearly avian influenza was those flocks needed to be destroyed in order to prevent the continued spread of that disease. And they needed to indemnify the farmers for their losses. The challenge for the Department of Agriculture here is that these are perfectly healthy animals, and the only reason they're being destroyed is because they can't be sent to the marketplace. And of course, we know they can't be sent to the marketplace because processing plants have been closed down because of ill workers. So they are kind of caught in the issue. The challenge will be for in my opinion, the USDA to expand the eligibility for the destruction and disposal of livestock herds, and or some supplemental assistance from the state, like has already been endeavored with the $11 million. But just that clarification that it's the animal disease thing that usually triggers USDA support.
Mr. Chair, and I would just point out to Director Kelly that in most cases, Chapter 12 does talk about natural disasters and or those that are an act of God. And if there ever was a natural disaster, I think this COVID-19 probably makes for a strong case under that. So I appreciate your efforts, and I know that you're endeavoring to make every opportunity through FEMA to clarify we've got an ag community that's just bedrock of our state that's really hurting right now. So we really appreciate your efforts. Thank you.
Okay, with that, what did I see, Director Rutan?
Mr. Chair, and just to be clear, the Coronavirus Relief Fund in their guidance release yesterday made it explicitly clear that the disposal and of livestock is covered as an expense under the Coronavirus Relief Fund.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to thank all of the people who testified and answered questions. It's appreciated. I know we had to kind of move things along a couple of times, but I think we got through the agenda in pretty good shape. So thank you very much. Mr. Sullivan. Kobe? Did he leave? We had him on the agenda. I was just going to announce that we were going to add him to the agenda later because he was the third person on the agenda. So with that, members, we are adjourned.